Welcome to another episode of Women Leading Validation. I'm your host, Dori Gonzalez-Acevedo. Today's spotlight conversation is with Anne Vu. Anne is the Senior VP of Quality, Regulatory, and Clinical at ZimV, and also a fellow chief member. Anne is a seasoned leader with more than 30 years of experience transforming organizations, a pioneer in the world of cleaning validation. Anne brings experience in the medical device, pharmaceutical, nutritional, and biological sectors. Anne joined ZimV from Zimmer Biomet, where she led quality and regulatory affairs for robotics and several other business units. She has also held progressive leadership roles with global companies including Ethicon, Ortho Clinical Diagnostics, Bausch & Lomb, and Steris. Anne's undergraduate degree is in chemistry, and her law degree gives her a unique perspective of the world of validation and its associated risks. One of the key takeaways is, from Anne's talk, validation isn't about the proof you put into your documentation, it's the story that you need to tell, from beginning to end, about why you'll get the results you anticipate every single time. Enjoy my conversation with Anne. Well, welcome, Anne. Thanks for joining us today on an episode of Women Leading Validation. I'm so excited to have you here with us.
I'm so glad to be here.
Yeah. And so it's been an interesting, I've been interviewing women to get onto the podcast, and I'm really excited because you were one of the top of the list here to reach out and say, hey, let's do something. So that's really awesome. I intro'd you, but I would love for us and the audience to hear a little bit more about who you are and how you came to be in this industry.
Sure. So I think I got into this industry because of a great leader that had some vision and foresight. And I was in a role that I believed was one of my dream jobs. I was a tech service chemist, and I thought I was going to change the world because I was solving customer problems day in and day out. And a wonderful leader reached out and said, Anne, do you want to go into quality or regulatory? And I said, neither. I love what I do. I want to be this tech service chemist. And she said, no, Anne, let me ask you again. Do you want to go into quality or regulatory? And I said, neither. And she said, okay, last time, final call. What do you want to do? And at that point, I actually chose to move into regulatory affairs. And subsequently, they sold the chemistry division of the company that I was in. So a very fortunate turn of events for me. But from that point forward, I spent my time in the healthcare medical devices space of quality and regulatory and validation, and pretty much have been in this side of the industry ever since. So very fortunate to have a leader that had some vision and foresight. So that's how I got here.
But it also sounds like you had a little bit of a circuitous route to get to where you are. Was it right from, undergrad?
No, it wasn't. So my route started in laboratories and analytical chemistry. That is my background. I started off with method validation, environmental testing. And from there, I moved into tech services chemistry. And then I got into the quality regulatory space. So I'm like so many people in this quality validation world. You know, at the time I was starting my career, there wasn't a degree or a program that even knew or was able to spell validation. So I think we all from my time, at least, we got here through routes which were not direct pathways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely hear that. Mm-hmm. It's and through that, I'm sure that you've garnered certain skill sets that you probably wouldn't have had if you went through a traditional route and just became an engineer or something like that.
That's true. I think there's a lot of discovery that happens when you're forging a pathway and you're trying to create something. I think there's so much that is garnered from kind of making it up as you go. I think I probably mentioned I was very involved in cleaning validation in its foundations. And only at some point much later did I get into the software CSV validation space. But that cleaning validation space came in as a way to answer a question. So we were asked by I was working for Steris Corporation at the time, and we were asked by our customers to prove that the products we were manufacturing were actually removed from a surface. So it was the foundation of cleaning validation. So it's very commonplace today to be able to demonstrate that residues are gone and demonstrate that a surface is clean. But that was something that hadn't been done at the time. And I was fortunate to help be able to build part of that. And that philosophy around say what you're going to do, do what you said, provide the documentation that tells the story, very much became the foundation of what I've done in the software validation space. I think so much of that directly translates to my law background as well. It's something I came to later in my career. And, you know, when I was in law school, a lot of my peers were struggling with the how to answer questions and how to defend what was being put in front of us. And I very specifically remember in our evidence classes, you know, our professor wanted us to do these mock evidence games. And I love them, right? Because I love arguing and defending. So that was great for me. But she would, you know, give us some facts, and then our job was to get those facts introduced. And she was definitely testing whether or not we knew the rules around whether or not the evidence could come in. But she was also getting us to concisely make an argument. And you can't just go fact, answer, and expect somebody to be able to understand your rationale, right? Mm-hmm. So it's fact, why these facts matter. And being in this, you know, this world where you have to tell why the facts matter and then get to your conclusion, that's really what validation is all about. So I think those things really helped me kind of further my quality regulatory career, further my knowledge. And it's a lot about how I think. And I think our teams really need to understand that process in telling the story as they think about validation.
I love this definition of how you've just described it. So as a fellow chemist, and I'm educated as a chemist and developed active pharmaceutical ingredients, for me, numbers matter, right? Like, you know,
right.
One plus one equals two, and that's a fact, and that's it. But this this crafting of the narrative, the crafting of the why, how many whys do we really need to answer before we actually get down to the root of it all, really have impact, right? To your point, right? And so for us, you know, starting out when validation just kind of was a thing that you have to prove, right? And we have made it up over the years in terms of computer software assurance and validation. Absolutely. What does that mean? But so I think we're, I think you might be in agreement with this. We're at a unique position now where we're trying to redefine what that is. And
exactly.
And what is the heart of the matter? What are we actually proving here, right? And I, you know, just to tangentially also pull in, you know, the world has shifted, you know, with COVID, through COVID, and now in the aftermath of COVID. And I think we're seeing a lot of impact from that. And I was wondering if you can tie those two things together, meaning, you know, why is quality and compliance so critical now more than ever?
So I think in the world where we were working with paper binders, and, you know, I think we all probably remember the inspections where, you know, the auditor's sitting in the room and then they start talking about validation and, you know, everybody starts to get panicked and people come rolling up with their carts or boxes full of binders. And the world was, you know, it's obviously a better story if you can dump all these binders and baffle them with binders versus, you know, tell your story based on the facts within. So I think we're not in the world where we can dump a bunch of binders in anymore, and because that's not how the world works. You know, auditors and inspectors expect us to be able to pop up on the screen in a heartbeat a clear, crisp, concise answer to whatever it is that they've queried, right? You know, they don't expect to be pulling through binders and finding answers. And frankly, we never really wanted to turn over all of that information to them in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. We never really wanted to do that, but that's kind of how it resulted. So I think now that we're in a much more digitized world where the outputs from our processes should be based on highest risk to lowest risk, and you know, thinking about that in the bigger picture, we want to focus where there is the biggest risk and not waste our time with binders and binders and binders and meaningless screenshots. Because, you know, it's not an effort metric. Having a validated system is not about the effort you put into it. It's all about the results. So, I don't want a pat on the head.
Right.
I just want the results.
That's a great, I like what you just said, that effort metric. That's a great framing mm-hmm. of something that I've been and preparing for in our next Connects GMP University is what are we actually measuring? And I think that there are those effort metrics that folks have historically put into place for valid reasons at the time, right?
Sure. At the time.
And so what is it now? What are the things that we really do need to measure from a quality perspective? What do you think?
So everybody uses these phrases, you know, risk-based approach, and they start throwing out things like risk-based approach. And, you know, the FDA has gone on record saying you can utilize a risk-based approach to execute your validation, but it all comes back to the rationale and the story and the why. So let me give you a specific, for instance. So our team is deploying an ERP system, right? And they came and they said, well, you know, I want you to sign this risk document because it says we're going to validate the GXP elements of the ERP because those are what's required and we're using a risk-based approach. And I said, not good enough. And I said, there are things that are part of GXP functionality, which are very low risk. There are things that are part of core financial functionality that are extremely high risk. So you haven't answered the question for me. Go back to the drawing board. Start thinking about the impact. It's the so what. So one of the things that I often ask my team is, what's the so what? You never want somebody else to be drawing a conclusion for you. You want to put forth your rationale that says what your conclusion is and why. So this element of functionality is high risk because if I don't perform it correctly, I could lose traceability of my product in the marketplace. If this element of functionality is not done correctly, I could become unable to pay my taxes, right? That's a pretty significant risk. In my eyes, if I'm not able to pay my taxes, that's a very big risk. So, you know, you have to take it all the way to the logical conclusion and provide the supporting rationale to define what the risk is. And I think our inability to manage risk sometimes comes back to a lack of understanding of what our processes are actually doing. And if we are better able to define the process, I think we can really get at what the true risks are, both, you know,
and when you say process, and I just want to check terminology here. I hear you mean intended use of mm-hmm. how are you going to use, like, what are you doing? Yeah. And yes. So I think yes. that I'm in agreement and in alignment with you. The inability to articulate what is the actual use, what is the actual process that you're using whatever for is still an art form in some cases mm-hmm. that has not yet been fine-tuned. And I love that you challenge your team to go back to the drawing board to say, this isn't good enough. And if it doesn't satisfy mm-hmm. your why, right, then it's clearly not going to identify, mm-hmm. Satisfy an auditor's why. And that's also important. Mm-hmm. I wonder if notion of if that's tied into, you know, being able to articulate how to mitigate a risk, right? And I wonder if there's some relationship there between, you know, folks thinking a plan is it is what it is, but hasn't taken it through the impact analysis and hasn't it taken it through the mitigation strategy. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So a risk may be okay as is if you are okay with whatever those consequences might be, right? So you don't have to mitigate every single risk. You just have to understand what the behaviors are going to be. And if you're okay with what that conclusion might be, then fine, leave it. I think sometimes we get all wrapped around the axle thinking you've got to mitigate every single risk, right? And I think if I go back to 14971 and, you know, as low as reasonably practicable and all that language, right? You know, all of our brains were set around getting it down to like the lowest number possible. But, you know, I think as business people, as leaders, we have to come to a place of balancing at what point does the effort to mitigate that risk become so great that it's no longer worth it, right? So it's okay to have small risks, or, you know, if the screen turns teal instead of blue, you know, on my graphical user interface, is that the end of the world? Probably not. If it's going to do other things, maybe. So I think, you know, we're so sometimes set about eliminating all defects or eliminating all risks that we kind of go off the deep end and forget the bigger picture. So
yeah. How do you manage? Yeah. So one of the criticisms I often hear is that, well, you know, you go from one quality person, you get one perspective, you go to another quality person, you get another perspective. How do you manage that variation within your team?
So it is true that, you know, different individuals have different perspectives. And I think, again, it comes back to aligning on the what you want up front. And, you know, regulators don't tell us how to do anything. Regulators tell us what the expectations are. And sometimes I think we forget that, right? So if I'm aligning with my team, or if my team is aligning with R&D or with other functions, I'm hopeful that we always come back to the same what. I'm fine if they have 74 different hows, but as long as we come back to that same what, that's where I want to be crystal clear on. And, you know, in thinking things through, I run things as a military operation, but I think if the objective is clear in the beginning, I want my team to come to work every day thinking about how to get there. So my role and the role of the leaders of my team is to clearly define that objective, clearly define that what, and let them use their brain about the how. Because if they are able to find a better way, find a better how, I am not the smartest person in the room, not by a long shot. So I want them to always come with their new ideas and their new hows. And the better we're able to align that how up front, and if there does become a dispute on the how, then we'll talk it through, or excuse me, the what, align the what and let them navigate the how.
I like what you're saying, and that not all leaders have the same objective and put that objective at the top. And I also see that the only way to move forward in an industry that typically is a laggard, right, in terms of process improvement and changes that can help drive, right, a new vision. So what are you thinking are some of the reasons for the why it's hard to shift in life sciences?
So I think a lot of it is the legacy, right? A lot of it is the history and where people are comfortable, right? You know, I think it's kind of come full circle, right? So In the early days, I'll say, in the early days, we kind of had to think about it and make it up. And then there was a time where there were recommendations, solutions, templates, guidelines that I'm not going to say were more cookbook, but it made things feel as if you could do things kind of rote. You could pull like out a template and you could just work it through and you could just get your answers. And what I think is we're finally back at a place where there's an expectation that we think about the process. We think about the solution. We think about what it is that we're trying to prove. We think about what we're trying to deliver. And there's the latitude and acknowledgement that, you know, more isn't better. Telling your story is much more important. And I think this has become even more evident with EUMDR and some of the other documentation that we're being asked to create as part of EUMDR. So you can use this example in the CSA space. You can use this in the biocompatibility space. You can use this in the cleaning space, right? But, you know, tying together that story and that rationale has become more important than ever because, you know, particularly in the world of biocompatibility, the cost for testing and the timeline for testing has just gone through the roof. So as an industry, we've acknowledged that we can't do it all with testing, right? We've got to find other ways. When the pressure in other areas becomes that great where we've got to find other solutions, I think we'll find a wholesale move to, you know, the CSA approach and the don't come with a million binders approach. But, you know, I think we have the opportunity as leaders in the space to apply that thinking no matter what world we're in. And, you know, the better business partners we are fundamentally, the more value we're going to bring to the business. Right? It doesn't matter what our title is. We should all have the same objective in mind, which is compliant, simple, and speedy, right? You know, those things can coexist. They don't have to be mutually exclusive.
So compliance, simple, and speedy. And when you say that, I think, you know, as a forward-thinking sort of way, how machine learning and AI have to be part of that process. And for me, part of the holdback of these legacy or, you know, older ways of thinking is really, you know, hampering on the new innovation that is possible, that is here today, that folks are not yet able to get onto, right, in some regards. Maybe some parts of the organization are better than others just because they're maybe more niche within a larger organization, right, that they can adopt more rapidly. But for the most part, and what we see, in at least in the enterprise, right, that there's just – they're still hard to shift to a new mindset, to a new technology. Yeah. What do you have any thoughts about machine learning or AI in this space?
So I am very much an advocate of machine learning, test automation, AI, things like that, because, you know, I think I said before, I'm not the smartest, right? And if there are tools that are going to be able to predict behavior faster than me being able to see a trend, or if there are tools that are going to help focus testing on things which need to be reproduced and allow my team to focus on things where there is some decision making that needs to happen, I'm all about optimizing process, optimizing the tools that are available to us. Now, I do believe that there's an investment that needs to be made in training the algorithms, right? And I think sometimes we get to the place where we think that the machine's just going to do it all for us. I think understanding the intelligence behind the intelligence is a really important science that more of us need to spend some time investing in. But if we're able to get there, so if we're able to understand the science, we, you know, because the machine will do
right,
something
yeah, and
if
that's,
you tell it to.
It's definitely the case. And I think that's also what I hear in some regards of, you know, when an organization might not be on a testing maturity that is upward moving, but kind of stagnant, the jump from that manual mm-hmm. testing kind of methodology to automation is often, well, we don't understand what the automation's really doing, right? And there's like a lot of hesitancy of what is it doing? And to your point of not educating oneself to understand what it is mm-hmm. or what it isn't, right? And that there are
right.
use cases right. and limited ways in which automation and machine learning and everything else has its place. If we define, back to your original point, mm-hmm. the boundaries, the process, the intended
yeah.
use of what it is
yeah.
and what it's going to do. And I think that mm-hmm. art, right, that art mm-hmm. of writing business requirements and is one in which mm-hmm. Doesn't necessarily get enough attention. I think you also mentioned that in terms of your kind of, you know, AI sort of conversation. You know, like you have to be willing to sit and understand mm-hmm. what it is we're trying to define. That's the hard thing, right? I mean, getting folks to mm-hmm. agree, this is what we're working
very
on.
Hard.
Again, to your why, like you can have five different ways of mm-hmm. testing something, right? But as long as the thing of which it is
sure.
is sufficient, right? Then you can use those five different ways mm-hmm. to get there, right? Yeah.
Exactly.
So you know, there's this trend of moving and wanting to get to the compliance, simple, speedy, right? The kind of really moving forward and mm-hmm. And the tools in which we have in order to get there, from a vendor side perspective, often, for the most part, they do very similar things, right? They do very similar things. And so part of what I hear yeah. you're saying is it's up to the company that's, you know, to decide how they're going to use those things, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think our obligation is to look at all that there is out there. And, you know, I think in my opinion, there's always going to be a balance between, you know, automation, machine, mm-hmm. and person, right? I think there's always going to be a mix and there's a place for both. And I think that, you know, as our organization, as organizations in general mature along that journey, they have to decide what that place is going to be. You know, as part of a new organization, we just became a new organization in March of this year, we're going through that transition ourselves. I think we understood what that looked like in our old world. And now we're, you know, with new eyes, taking a look at where we want to be in our world, right? You know, we had a toolbox that we were utilizing that didn't necessarily come over for us in our new world. Okay, so we do have to do something different. So it's time to take a look and reevaluate. And, you know, whether I had this compelling business driver of, you know, the organizational spin or not, I think it's in everybody's best interest to revisit that at regular frequency, right? And take advantage of what new tools might be available
right.
to us. So,
never stop looking. That's great.
Never stop looking.
I would like to shift and talk about women leading validation. Is that okay?
Sure.
The
sure.
You know,
sure.
How I came to be in this space. It's been you know, me mentoring as young women in the last couple of years, and I'm really kind of digging in deep to try to give back. And you know, some of the questions that I'm mm-hmm. often asked about are, you know, being the only woman in the room, how are things have actually changed? How are you able to manage, you know, who you are as a woman as well as a leader within organizations? I was wondering mm-hmm. if you could share some of your thoughts on that.
Sure. So this one is a really interesting one for me because I get this question often as well. And I have been the only woman in the room for pretty much my entire career. I'll go all the way back to my very, very early days when I was an undergrad. And, you know, I received an award for, you know, Outstanding Chemistry Student of the Year. And, oh, by the way, you know, this is phenomenal recognition. You're the first female to have ever won this award. And I'm thinking, what? Why is that even a deal? Why is that even a thing? And, you know, I never really thought about it at the time. And I guess my advice to women in technology, women in this space is you're going to hear a lot about being the only woman in the room. Don't let it be an issue until it is an issue. And you have a valid and legitimate voice based on what you know, what you bring to the equation, what you bring to the table, and let that be what guides your conversation, what guides your position on any of a variety of issues. Don't let the fact that you're a woman get stuck in your head. Just be there, be present, and address that being the only woman in the room if it becomes an issue. I've been very fortunate to, you know, always be able to advocate for my own position. It wasn't until I got to more senior levels where being a female became an issue. And it wasn't an issue earlier in my career. And it was only when I got to like the director level when some weird things started happening, and I started observing this, you're the only woman and you get talked over, you get treated differently. And just my message is always remember that you have a voice. You do. And always be you. And it's helpful to have a mentor and an advocate. And someone that isn't necessarily going to clear the roadblocks for you, but someone that can tell you, yeah, I experienced that, or no, I didn't experience that. How did it make you feel? And what you can do differently in the future? Just somebody to bounce ideas. So I think that's one of the best things that we can do for each other as female leaders is be the sounding board, be the other voice, because I'm sure it probably has happened to pretty much all of us, right? So don't let it be an issue until it is an issue, and have a network of females around you to kind of help you navigate if
happen. And so what around that in go ahead. You had another thought?
Yeah. So I love history, and there's a couple of stories in particular. If you're an aficionado, I just love them. So there's one, it's called The Only Woman in the Room, and the author is escaping me, but it's the story of Hedy Lamarr. And she truly was the only woman in the room, and she was really quashed because she didn't have the fancy degrees and this, that, and the other. But she was actually brilliant, right? And she made her point, and she made her voice heard. And then there's another one. It's about women who smash codes, and she was a code decryptor during the war, and her name's Elizabeth Smith. And stories like that really remind me that, yes, I face challenges, but they're nothing like the challenges that some of those women have historically faced. So it gives me courage just to continue to be vocal.
Yeah, I like those stories as well. And you know, one of the things as I develop my own leadership style is really trying to make sure and continue to push myself into promoting inclusion across the board at the workplace. And so I, you know, so I wonder if you have some thoughts about how do you do that? Like whether it's in an individual room or within your team, any tips or thoughts for others out there?
So I think it becomes even more important in this virtual world that we're in, because it can be easy for people that don't necessarily want to be on camera to kind of go unheard in a conversation or in a meeting. And I think it's my obligation as a leader to say, hey, Hannah, you know, what are your thoughts? Or, you know, to pull others into the conversation. And diversity of thought, diversity of opinion, diversity of pretty much everything is what's going to help us get to the best solution possible. So I think it's being mindful of pulling other opinions out. And I can't just let the, you know, I'm true confessions. I am a talk fast, run fast, get to a solution fast kind of individual. And it could be really easy for me to just say in the first 15 minutes, we got our answer and move on. But, you know, I don't want to talk something to death, but I also want to make sure that the counterpoint has heard. And, you know, sometimes asking questions like, what's the worst thing that could happen in this situation? And, you know, getting people to think about, you know, could we be okay with that worst thing? It is helpful. And it also gives those that might have doubts about their own opinion an opportunity to speak up. So giving them a forum.
Yeah, I like that. One of the things that I like to do is often ask the question that everyone thinks is a stupid question, right? And I ask it intentionally, right? So that it breaks, you know, the surface and the, you know, the whatever is going on in the room to be able to articulate something back to the basics, because frankly, sometimes things are missed when it's not asked, right? Because yes, right. I'm very similar to you wanting to get to, you know, the next answer, right? And at the same time, if it hasn't been kind of digested, right, by who's actually going to execute whatever the plan is, then that's a miss too, right? If we're not slowing down the conversation to have some of those basic fundamental things asked to begin with. Yeah.
And I think, you know, my self-awareness that, you know, I've done all these personality profiles. I'm a red, I'm a, you know, I'm an ENTJ, I'm going to judge, I'm extroverted, you know, I'm just kind of like, go. I respect the opinions and the ideas that, of those that are different than me, because they're going to bring a different window to the data. They're going to bring a different side to the analysis that I'm not. And I just, you know, have to force myself to be mindful to look for those other opinions and encourage my leadership team to do the same.
Honestly. It is. It's a practice, right? It's a ongoing practice. It's when you get, you know, that self-advocacy and wanting self-advocacy for others as well in the room, right? To be able to have that. So quality, regulatory, not really. I mean, there's few and far between educational programs that are just specific to this kind of area. And so I think we're still looking at young people coming out of college. And how would you sell, you know, come and be a quality professional to those new folks?
So I would say, you know, quality is not for the faint of heart. It's for those that love a challenge and those that love to solve a problem. So if you're the one that took apart the transformer and found every way to put it back together, if you're the one that never rested until you answered every question that was in the cartoon, I mean, you know, why did Bugs Bunny do what he did? I don't know. I think if you're the one that's always asking questions, you're probably going to be well suited to a quality career, right? Because that's what we do, is we solve and answer questions every single day. I think the other thing that we forget about being in the quality world is it's not black and white. We live in a world of blurry and gray. And if you're okay with that, then come on. Come on to quality, right? Because you're going to be forging a pathway every single day. If you like to write and tell a story that is going to, you know, convince something that something is compliant or isn't compliant, come to quality. There's so many things that we could talk about so many different avenues from a quality perspective. If you want to,
it's interesting that the living in the gray, what you talked about, because part of, I wholeheartedly agree with that statement, right? And, you know, if I even compare within my own household, right? My husband's a federal contractor, right? And there is black and white, right? And that is very, very clear and feels very comfortable within that scope. And for me, that doesn't feel normal, right? Like it isn't black and white. There is all this variety of gray, and it makes me feel comfortable to be able to continue to hone in on exactly what hue of gray that is, because I have this question to ask or this question to ask question. And that curiosity, I think, is, you know, you know, similar to your background, but also for me as a chemist, right? Like this kind of scientific curiosity mindset is almost essential to this role, right? I think a lot in the computer systems space, you know, when we have a developer, like they want it to be black. There's like it's ones and O's, right? It's black and white. It's this or that, and there's a lot of other varieties in there, and I think that also goes into the variety of answers and responses we get within a quality group. And when we're trying to put so circle back around to the metrics part, right? What metrics do we actually put into place to figure out how well something is doing or not in this gray space, right?
So, but before I answer the metrics to help us understand whether or not our systems are performing or not performing, let me be clear. There is one thing which is totally black and white, and that is the patient safety aspect, right? I never, ever will I compromise on patient safety or that. So I don't want anybody to walk away thinking that is blurry or gray, because in my mind, patient safety is the only thing I'll never, ever compromise. But, you know, when we're thinking about metrics and measures, there are those that I see which help me understand whether or not my system is performing. So my quality system itself, right? So, you know, the Kappa scores, the, you know, the metrics around timeliness, things like that. There's the metrics and measures that help me understand whether or not, or what my customer is feeling, right? You know, so the defects per million opportunities, the complaints, the things like that. And then there's the metrics that help me understand whether or not I'm compliant, right? So things like recall scores and things like that. So I kind of put my metrics into a variety of categories, and the scorecard that we work from includes metrics and measures in all of those spaces, right? So I can, you know, and you don't want too many metrics, right? Because then you become so diluted that you're not going to understand a signal if you see one. But, you know, kind of boiling it down to those three buckets, internal, external, and just like core compliance, that way I'm able to kind of look at the holistic health of my quality business, right? And you could focus that down to, like a system or an application too. So let's talk about maybe an ERP or manufacturing execution system or something like that. You could look at things that the user is going to feel. You could look at things that you know, someone beyond the user is going to feel. You can create metrics and measures. Again, you can't go off the deep end, but you know, look at both perspectives is my advice, I guess. You know, look at things that are going to be within your control and measurable, and then look at things that others are going to feel, and have a scorecard that takes into consideration both. Because if you focus all internally, you could be thinking you're a rock star, and the folks on the other side think you stink.
Great.
So
great
balance.
Well, and it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us today. I'm really excited.
Thank you.
Yeah. So we'll be publishing this. And then we'll also, hopefully we'll be doing some more women's panel in the future with you.
Absolutely. Would be
great.
Thrilled to
Thanks
participate.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.